Ready. What is the difference between the subconscious and the unconscious? Well, that term, we don't actually use that term in Vedanta, but it is used in some different schools of psychology, where the subconscious is, as I understand it, is just almost conscious. It's kind of easily accessible. It's right under the radar. Where the unconscious is not that easily accessible. You kind of have to go in and do inner child work and pull things up or do dream, work with your dreams and things like that to actually bring the unconscious up. But the subconscious kind of means subliminal. You know, it's right on the boundary line of being conscious. So you have much more access to it. I don't really know any much more than that in terms of those terms. They're not Vedanta terms, they're psychology terms, and we don't use it in Jungian psychology, and the psychologies I've studied the most, they don't really use it, but just generally I think that's the meaning as I understand it. During meditations you say, now focus your buddhi. In your simple presence, focus on your own presence, on yourself. That's how I say. Therefore, I see my consciousness through my mind. Then my doubt is, how do I see that consciousness is not the product of the mind? How do I know that when I die and this mind is gone, my consciousness still is? Now the relationship between the buddhi, if you see the buddhi just as a sattva, it's made of sattva, that means in a sense it has the sense of consciousness. And how that plays out in terms of our language is any thought modification that you have, like any perception, an emotion, a fantasy, a memory, any type of vritti, right, is known. That is knownness is the nature of the self. That's conscious. That is knownness is like a synonym for just consciousness. And so it's vritti consciousness, you can say. And remember, you have to remember that the vritti itself, along with the rest of the creation, is mitya. That means that the vritti is continually changing. One vritti replaces the next vritti, replaces the, so there's a flow of vrittis. So they're all coming and going. Consciousness doesn't really require the vrittis at all, nor does it require the buddhi to focus on it in order for it to be known, because it's self-evident consciousness. So what actually happens, what is the usefulness when if I say just gently change your focus? It's that the vritti itself now, instead of having for its content objectifiable experiences, whether it be sense, perception, etc., that is its content, and that content is pervaded as though, because of the sattva, by consciousness. And so then your whole relationship with the vritti is really in terms of labeling the consciousness as the knower and the object of consciousness as the known. Really all that there is the vritti consciousness. So whatever is in the vritti, that is known. There really is no experience of a knower. But anyway, that's a little bit irrelevant. But for now, the vritti is used to being filled with objects, with objectifiable experiences like sense perceptions, etc. Like now, if I'm looking this way, I'm gaining a vritti of this room, which is, these are the nama-rupas filling the vritti, which is then illumined by consciousness. Okay. Now imagine this vritti, which can look this way or that way or up or down or in and out. It can really direct its attention anywhere? What if it directs its attention toward the knownness or the conscious being, you know, that is itself? The buddhi even thinks, this is myself, I am a conscious being. Right? That's its ajnanam. What's ajnanam about, ignorance about that, is that it is identifying the vritti and its changing contents and its sense of knowership with consciousness, with the self. That's the problem. But the truth is that the self is its self. There's no other self there. So what happens when the buddhi turns toward the consciousness that's illumining it? Then the only experience that the vritti is having is the experience of the consciousness because of which it is known. And so that brings about, in a sense, a samadhi experience. And here what we mean by samadhi experience is that there's no subject-object relationship at that time. Right? There can't be, because the object of the vritti is the subject, which is illumining it. So subject is illumining a vritti of the subject. So what is happening there, in a sense, is that the vritti, the buddhi vritti, is erasing itself, as though resolving itself into the subject that illumines it. And so when that happens, so say that has happened, the buddhi turns toward the subject. Now the buddhi comes out of being no longer turning toward the subject, but is turning toward the object, just as normal, it usually does. But then what it will realize, there's several things, so maybe the major is, one of the things it realizes is that the subject that it had turned its attention toward, kind of like a mirror, remains exactly as it was. And now that same subject is now the same me, but illumining all of these namarupas, because the buddhi is turning out this way, right? And so just by that simple act, there is a viveka that takes place, where the buddhi recognizes kind of the non-dual in terms of subject-object nature of the self, the knownness, the self-evident nature of the self, the self-shining as consciousness of the self. That remains exactly the same, but what has happened on the part of the buddhi is that it has been able to differentiate its activities from the stability of the self. Because when you recognize the self, it never changes. It is absolutely stable. It is always the same. The buddhi goes on changing. Its contents continually change. But the consciousness that the buddhi enjoys never changes. Okay? So now there's a viveka. Even though the two things are existing in the same time and space, there's a viveka, and the viveka has to do with the order of reality. One is coming and going, one goes into unmanifest condition, one goes into the dream state, you know, we go through this, the waking state, dream state, deep sleep state, and then you're just your moment-to-moment-to-moment experience of this changing buddhi that is changing in something which is not changing. And so now there's a viveka between that which doesn't change and that which changes. And both are happening at exactly the same time. So it's not that the buddhi is the consciousness that's illumining the self, but what it recognizes is the self, or the consciousness which illumines it, you know, is free from it. Because the buddhi goes on changing and its content goes on changing, except for one thing. And then that is the consciousness, which is its own self. So it recognizes that the consciousness is its own self. And at the same time, it recognizes the consciousness, which is myself, the I, the me, is changeless. Because you cannot, it is absolutely impossible to experience even the smallest iota of change in consciousness. For consciousness, there's no time, there's no space, there's no change. We'll just wait till you get in here. we're attached to and really only know ourselves as a knower, you know. And the knowership is something that we label consciousness to consciousness, because we make a differentiation within the buddhi between the knower and the known, which is really a differentiation between consciousness, right, and the object of consciousness. So who am I going to take myself to be, the object of consciousness or the consciousness? I will always take myself to be the conscious being. Comes in very handy, that's just a fact, that comes in very handy when we do this drishaviveka, where the buddhi, along with everything else, becomes recognized as an object of consciousness and then differentiated from the consciousness. Okay, so in this process of drishaviveka, where the buddhi itself becomes an object of consciousness, you recognize that it is known, then we're left with the nature of the sakshi, consciousness is the sakshi, because we have this knowership so much ingrained in us. So the consciousness that illumines the buddhi is called the sakshi or the knower. Then we think that the atma, the self itself, is a knower. But what happens when the buddhi itself turns toward the consciousness that is illumining? Because there's a viveka there now. So if we do the drishya, there's a viveka. You're left with the recognition that the buddhi is illumined. It is known. And as I illumine it, goes on changing, right? But the one who's the luminary doesn't change at all. So now the buddhi focuses on the luminary and the consciousness. And consciousness is not changing. And now the buddhi is focusing on the one who doesn't change, who is the luminary. And in doing that, the subject-object knower-known differentiation resolves itself into just pure consciousness. You can say knower consciousness and object consciousness is neither the knower or the known. That's what ends up happening. The knower and the known become object consciousness, and consciousness remains free of both of them. So the buddhi can't be the consciousness if it itself is illumined and already and always changing. There is no possibility of the subject being the object. There's always a differentiation between the knower and the known. When you resolve that differentiation, then the consciousness is, you can either say, it is both knower consciousness and known consciousness being free of both, or it is just consciousness. In fact, the sakshi resolves into just consciousness. And then your recognition of the buddhi itself just becomes buddhi consciousness. There is no knower at all. There's just consciousness. And the buddhi goes on changing consciousness. Consciousness is not changing. But all of these different modifications are taking place in the changeless consciousness. So the one cannot be another. Can't be the other. Because then consciousness would have to be changing. That's a huge problem in itself. If consciousness is changing, then what was it before it changed? Consciousness goes through a change. What was it before? It's just like anything in samsara. If it can go through a change, then it's something that exists within time and space. Yeah? That's not possible for consciousness, because everything that exists within time and space itself is objectifiable. So consciousness can't go through any change. But everything that's objectifiable, including the buddhi, is continually changing. Continually coming into being and going out of being. So there's no way the one can be the other except in the satya-mitya relationship. And in the satya-mitya relationship, the buddhi has consciousness 100%, because the consciousness is the adhishtana, it is all that's actually there. Where the buddhi has no being apart from consciousness, apart from existence, but itself can't be existence because it changes and it's objectifiable. So you go round and round. That's where it goes. Hope that helps. But we'll be doing it many times in many different ways. Yeah. I'm just doing kind of a speed version of it. I think you said the other day that Maya has two capacities, avadanam and vikshepa. I have previously heard these capacities as belonging to Ajnanam. Can you please talk about the connection here? Yeah. when we say Maya itself has two capacities, avarana is the capacity to cover, vikshepa is the capacity to project. But now we look at that Maya from the standpoint of Ishwara, which is the manifestation, Maya having its total manifestation. When we're talking about Ishwara, Ishwara is the one who is identified with the total manifestation of Maya. So there is no limitation, there's no ajnanam, because there's nothing that's not known. See, if you think of just the vritti, of any given vritti you have, that vritti, which is sattva, is known. Because of the sattva, it is known. So if you look at Ishvara, the maya, the total maya upadhi, samashti, maya upadhi, samashti means the whole, sattva, rajas, tamas, pervading the, which is maya, so maya is sattva, rajas, tamas, so the whole maya unfolds, it projects, then the, what we call the Ishvara's abhimana, there is a natural identification from the standpoint of the maya upadhi of the self. Right? So the maya upadhi, its experience is it has a self. That's what we call Ishvara. Because this creation has for its being, Satchit, the Satchit Atma, is itself. Now if you say, it's a little aside, say you think, well, I have a self and that self is Satchit, and it is the, my experience of a being, of me. Me, this self that I am, who is a conscious being. So that's what we're talking about, this very personal me experience. Now the thing is, this me experience, if I can say that, not an objectifiable experience, but just my nature, my swarupa, the very nature of myself. So now, this experience, if I were to get rid of the body, mind, sense organs, what would happen to it? When you say me, is there anything about your body, mind, sense organs that is responsible for this me experience, that I am a conscious being that we label as me? I like to use the word me, because otherwise, you know, conscious being doesn't quite do it. Like if you say, I am conscious being, what kind of image comes to your mind? It's just someone I don't know, basically. Really, I'm a conscious being. Okay. But what really is the conscious being experience in our language? What does that mean? How do we label it in our day-to-day language? We label it as me. But the problem is that this me is then superimposed upon by the mind. But it's the same me. The me experience belongs to conscious being. That conscious being is me. And that's the me experience. So when you think of yourself, or I, or me, what you're pointing to, what you're referring to, what you're labeling as me, is Brahman, is conscious being. There's only one conscious being. There's only one me. The mistake, the ajnanam, is this body, mind, sense organs, is superimposed on that. So I'm taking all of these dresses that I'm wearing, these upadis, to be responsible for making me me, or giving me the sense of self. And then even though, and the mind gets all convoluted here, because you can think, even though I'm in truth, according to the Upanishads, I am limitless conscious being, I'm much more attached to me. The me experience, what makes me me. So limitless conscious being is wafting around out here somewhere, and my attachment remains the same to me that is this body, mind, sense organs. We have this what we call mutual superimposition is totally ingrained. We don't think of it as a mutual superimposition. So it's actually a task in terms of wielding this pramana for the student to recognize that it is this very personal me that I've taken to be the body, mind, sense organs is exactly the one we're talking about. The one you already take to be yourself, which already is yourself, there's no mistake there. Who you take to be you is the one we're talking about. It's just we're showing you, the Upanishads, I'm saying, we, the Upanishads are revealing to you that this me that I've convinced is this body, mind, sense organs, and very personal to me, it is this very me that is Brahman, not some Satchidananda, you know, self. Now, it just happens that I can define this very personal me as existing, I am, I exist, as being conscious, I am a conscious being, that's Sat, that's Chit. But somehow we have to bring these theoretical concepts down into myself and realize that these words are actually just talking about this me that I've always known to be me. That's why when you gain knowledge, self-knowledge, it's so exciting because it's talking about me, and I had never realized really that I was free like that, that actually there's never even ever any birth or death for me. I am timeless, in fact, and nothing ever changes me or touches me, nor can it. Somebody used to say, even Ishwara can't do anything about it, because Ishwara is the Maya Upadhi, right? So this sense of self, this is actually who you are, and the Upanishads is doing all types of teaching methodologies to make you realize that, like, it's kind of a shock. Because, I mean, it was a shock for me, and I thought, oh, they're talking about me. That was, you know, a few years into this. I go, oh, okay. That was a big realization for me. You know, that they're actually, it is this me that is the self of Ishwara. That Ishwara is me. That Ishwara's self is myself. And that the myself is not something unknown. Experientially, I am completely known to myself experientially as me. It's just there's also a jnanam there, which causes me to take this me to be one of the body, mind, sense organs. So the Upanishads have to very painstakingly unravel that whole identification born of ignorance. So then I recognize that I am the self that they're talking about, and I am the one whose nature is Ananda. And then more and more unfoldment keeps going with more and more logic to make you recognize how this whole delusion has taken place. It's not taken place, it's inborn. So now to get back, Maya has two capacities, avarna and vikshepa. When we're talking about Ishwara, the avarna capacity is not in play. Because for Ishwara, that's just the whole infinite Maya Upadhi manifest with no ajnanam, no ignorance anywhere. But for the jiva, there's both avarna and vikshepa. The avarna, so first of all, the vikshepa is just this body-mind-sense organ, which is part of the Ishwara Upadhi, of Ishwara's body. This body is part of that. You know, so that's Ishwara's vikshepa, includes this physical body and subtle body also. But the avarna, because this body is like a wave in the ocean, it's a part to the whole, it has only limited knowledge. And so the self experience, the me experience is there, you know, because that is really the adhishtana of the whole Maya. There's nothing that's away from that me experience. And the me experience belongs to me, to the self. The body, mind, sense organs does not contribute to that in any way. When you think me, it's landing on the one who is me, which is consciousness. It's not the body is adding a little bit of meanness to me, sprinkling a little meanness on the Atma, you know. That is me. But because of the limited upadis and the limited mind, that mind, which is contained within tamas, form this body, and the rajas, the pranas, it's all contained and kind of mixed together, you know, that creates a limitation in terms of my knowledge. I have the self-experience of me, but it's mixed up with the body-mind-sense organs, the rajas and the tamas. And so my mind has no way to differentiate itself from the self. There's no pramana for it. There's just the sense of being, which is true. That's the adhishtana. But always recognized from the standpoint of the mind that is situated in the body and that has sense organs. So there's that confusion. First, Bhagavan gave us our own little maya vikshepa. We get to be Ishwaras. We get to be like Ishwara to our imagination. You know, to our fantasies. We did these exercises, if I ask you to imagine something, you are the Ishwara of that imagination. And you can see what it's like to have just a vikshepa, because there's no ajnanam there. You don't have the imagination and think you've become the imagination or identify with a character and become that character. You know, clearly, you know, that vikshepa is there. It's differentiated from you. But of course, if we go any farther, then you take yourself to be the body and all of that starts coming in. But just purely, if I ask you to have an imagination, your relationship with that imagination, you're the adhishtana of the imagination, and there's no confusion. So as jivas, it's kind of interesting. We have that avarana that Ishwara does not have because we can't recognize the self in its own nature, in the me, the freedom of myself. We can't recognize that without a pramana. Because the mind is, it never has an experience without me. And so why shouldn't it be me? You know, it doesn't experience me. It doesn't experience itself without me. Just takes itself to be me. It makes sense. You know, so somebody has to come along with a pramana, which are the Upanishads, and hold up that mirror so I can understand. That's probably enough. I never know if it's enough or not, but you'll be hearing it so much it won't matter. I think I can. Can you please explain the different states of samadhi, nirvikalpa, sahaja, and maha samadhi? This is mostly out of Driktrisha Viveka, these differentiations. But yeah, let me see. First of all, samadhi has to do with the buddhi being absorbed in or purely reflecting the nature of the self. That's what we mean. The D is the buddhi. It has that samatvam, that complete shanti that is resolving or turned toward my own being. I can say that. So it's not objectifying objects that can be objectified, subtle or gross. Rather, it is resolving itself for this type of samadhi. It's resolving itself, turning toward my own being. So now, when the buddhi just turns toward me, where I as though become its object, right? The one who's illumining it is the one that it's focused on. It is as though erasing, it's not erasing itself because it's still there, but it's erasing any content other than the self. And so we have two terms around this. One is called savikalpa, one is called nirvikalpa. So when the mind is, the buddhi is first just focused on myself, I'm kind of absorbed into that, so it's not being disturbed by other mental conditions that are taking place. Things might be perceived or whatnot, but it's not really disturbing in any way that focus on myself. But when I'm doing that, I'm still aware, the buddhi is still aware that, you know, I am turning my attention toward me, toward the self. So that outline of the buddhi is still there. That's called savikalpa. There's still a vikalpa. So the buddhi feels that it is aware of me and, oh, it's so absorbed and it loves that. And, you know, it's aware of its own self in that, its own buddhiness in that, as it has for its content just me, but it's still aware of itself. When that outline of the buddhi that only has me for its content is overwhelmed by the content about myself, there is no perceivable vikalpa between the seer, knower, and the known. So we say in that type of samadhi, there's nirvikalpa, There's no differentiation between the knower and the known, where in Satipatthana, the buddhi is still kind of self-aware, like the outline of the buddhi. So it's aware of the experience it is having, even though there's no other experience taking place. So it's still a samadhi, but that outline of the buddhi is still there until it's overwhelmed. So there is no outline of the buddhi, no as though knower known relationship. There's just, you're just abiding as yourself. So we say the mind is still there, but that is called, that mind is called an ati sukshma vritti. It's a very, very subtle, because it's totally overwhelmed by the nature of the self. So that's the savikalpa nirvikalpa. One example they use for that in the Prakarana Granthas, if you hold a candle flame up to the sun, right? So you're holding this candle flame, and the outline of the, so you're holding it like this, you're holding it right up to the sun. The strength, the power of the sun overwhelms the candle flame. So for a moment you can see the outline of the candle flame, but it gets overwhelmed by the power of the sun. At that time, then there's only the sun that's being experienced there, even though that outline, that candle is still there, right? But it's overwhelmed by the content. And that's called nirvikalpa. So you have savikalpa and nirvikalpa. Sahaja samadhi is, and just sahaja means natural. So that is a natural samadhi. Like, for instance, if you're, well, let me say it this way. You're never, in a sense, especially for a jnani, you're never not in samadhi, because the mind is mitya, you know. So the only one that's really there is the self. It's like having the clay say that, well, the clay has a sahaja, the pot has a sahaja samadhi because it's never away from the clay. So it's always walking around as clay. But it doesn't know that, so there's a jnana there. But what if it knows that? What if the pot recognizes its relationship to the clay? When is the clay not there? When is it not clay? And it's the same with your mind. When are you not there? Right. At what time, in what way, is the adhishtana away from mitya? And the adhishtana here is me, is conscious being. So, in what way am I ever separate from whatever I'm doing? And so that's a natural samadhi. In fact, in Aparoksha Nibbuti, it's a beautiful text by Shankara. It has a lot of verses, 150 verses, something, I don't remember. But in the last section, he's talking about samadhi. And he said, do we really have to sit when we're doing samadhi? You have to sit? What if I'm walking? Am I not in samadhi if I'm walking? Is myself not present? Yeah. And he makes jokes like that. But they're wonderful jokes. I mean, he's tongue-in-cheek, but it's also so true. Like, when are you not there? When does any part of the mind have any distance whatsoever from you? When is it not just a clay pot, you know? And so when the self is recognized, there's no time when you're not in samadhi. In some verses they'll say, I am the samadhi. I am the samadhi because I'm the one who's illumining the buddhi, and I'm the one that the buddhi is focused on, so I am the samadhi. There is no other samadhi other than me. I am that. And so whatever the vritti may be, it is nothing but me. But then to understand that, you have to have knowledge. But that's a sahaja samadhi. So you don't feel like, I have to go meditate so I can be in samadhi. You are the samadhi. There is no experience that's away from you. So that's very nice to understand that's very freeing, especially when you get that, you know. You don't get it. It's not just getting it in a theoretical way, because the fact of it is that yourself is never covered by any experience you have, and that's just a fact to be recognized. That's what we call this aparocignanam. This is something that needs to be recognized. Until it's recognized, and it's just them. Sounds good. You know, this is what they say in the Vedanta. Sounds good. But that's not knowledge. That's not the aparocignanam, where you actually see the fact of it. That there is no experience of any kind, light and dark, you know, that covers you or is away from you. And so that recognition is just what we call sahaja samadhi. And the other mahasamadhi is when the jnani leaves the body, dies. That's the great samadhi, mahasamadhi. So we don't say, talk this like the Swami has died. We say he had his mahasamadhi. It means that the body and the upadis are now just gone. Now it's just Ishwara. Ishwara is just Brahman with the Maya Upadi. The Maya Upadi belongs to Brahman as an incidental attribute. You are Brahman. The Jiva Upadi is gone. You are Ishwara. That's what it amounts to. And that's the Mahasamadhi. No limitations. Ajnanam is completely gone. Not to, you're no longer tied to Ajnanam or to the body, mind, sense organs, which are a product of that Ajnanam, actually. Even though you can gain knowledge of this body, mind, sense organs, but still, product of Ajnanam, it actually belongs to Ishwara. So, just take Mahasamadhi as when the prarabdha for the jnani is over, we call that Mahasamadhi. And even if we talk about it, usually, if I say Swamiji died or passed away, that's not really appropriate. You say Swamiji. Within India, anyway. You said, you know, just in the West, they wouldn't know what you're talking about, but usually when you refer to Swamiji, you know, like when Swamiji had his Mahasamadhi. Can you be aware of awareness itself? In meditation, the buddhi turns toward itself, however the self cannot be objectified. Yeah, the buddhi, what happens there is that the buddhi erases its content, right? And so it's not that the buddhi is not aware of the self. It has erased its content, and now the only content that it has is the self, which is the awareness that illumines the buddhi. So it's aware of the self not as though it becomes the subject aware of the object, but it is now, let's say the buddhi vritti has no object other than the subject. Right? Because usually it has all kinds of different objects. Now the only object of the buddhi is the one that illumines it. So the subject-object differentiation is resolved because there's nothing there to be objectified other than the subject that illumines the buddhi, right? So, what was the question? Just on. So, no, awareness is not aware of awareness in a subject-object way. Like, say inside of you, you are awareness, and in that there's this activity going on where this awareness is aware of the awareness and this awareness is aware of the awareness. There's no awareness aware of awareness. Awareness is awareness. And so it is aware of itself, but not by any type of action. So no subject-object activity. It is just self-shining, self-evident. Like you can use, sometimes we use as a drishtanta, as an illustration, like for instance the sun or a light. Is the sun doing something to illumine itself? No, it's not doing anything to illumine itself. It's luminosity itself. It doesn't need to do anything to illumine itself because it is the very luminosity, right? So the subject-object differentiation where there has to be a knower of the known and a wearer of the awareness. So we're used to this type of know or known, see or seen dichotomy in order to explain how anything is known. So then we want to make awareness have an awareer in it somehow, so that the awareness would be aware of awareness. But there's no duality like that for awareness to be aware of awareness. Awareness is awareness. Aware is aware, you know, not of anything other than itself, and it's not even aware of itself. It just is awareness. So this is something, these kind of questions are very valuable questions, especially when you're contemplating. And you're just sitting there with yourself, you know, with your own, just being with yourself. And then the Buddha can ask all kinds of questions, because the Buddha can ask about you, can ask you about you, can ask you about your thoughts, about anything he wants to. So it can, you know, the Buddha just recognizing, having differentiated itself from me, realizing that it's illumined by me, it can ask and look, kind of look and analyze, like, am I the self, am I knowing anything, including myself? Am I knowing anything? I'm not knowing anything at all. There's no second thing that I am knowing. I am just self-evident. So I am known without a knower. I am known without subject-object relationship. Now, in the world, we only think of knower-known. Subject-object relationship, that's what we think of. How do I know something? Because I'm a knower of that. But here we're in the world of non-duality. Brahman is not an object within duality, within time, within space. And yet, it is awareness. So what is the experience to just be awareness? It's self-evident, it's self-shining, it is known without a knower. When we say self-evident, that means it is known because awareness itself. So this word known, we only think of known in reference to the knower. You know, but actually the knownness, this is what I like to talk like this, but it doesn't always work anyway. But I think it's really good once you get it. The knownness that we label, this is known, this is known, this is known, this is known. There's no knownness known out there. The knownness is the awareness itself. The knownness is the self-evident adhishtana, right? And so for me, says a jiva, with these body, mind, sense organs, all this, everything I experience is known. The self is known because it's self-evident. And everything shines after the self-evident self. And when it says it shines after, it's called anubhati. All of this, the whole creation, shines after the self, which is bhati, which itself shines. Everything shines after that. And so that, another way of saying that is everything that we experience is just shining after my own nature. Right? There is no duality there of a knower known. You know? There's no such thing. There's just known. And we can show, just using this word known as really consciousness, I could say, you know, the wall is known, you are all known. To me, the wall is known, you are all known, this body's, these clothes are known, the body is known, my sense organs are known, my mind is known, and the buddhi is known, the ahankara is known, I am known. Where's the knower? The knower is really just conscious being. There's no knower. There's no experience of a knower. It's just language. Something to your mind and to your sense organs. We call the mind and sense organs the knower because they, as though, reflect because of sattva consciousness. And then we don't identify with the things that are known unless they're an upadhi. So I'm the knower, I'm the conscious being, and these things are known. It's all fake. I mean, it's a use of language that divides up the pie in a way that has never been, a pie that's never been cut has been divided up in a false way. because we've never had it. There is no knower. There's, consciousness is not a knower. Mm-hmm. Consciousness is known. And every experience we have, you know, shines after that knownness. So, of course, every experience you have is known because the Atma, the Self, is the Adhishtana of all experiences, and the Atma is self-evident. So another word for self-evident, it is known without a knower. It simply shines of its own accord. And so everything that comes into its wake as it being the Adhishtana is known. Because the Self is known. And we can do more of that later. Because it'll go all sorts circling around. One more. The Sukshma Sharira enlivens the human body and the mind, takes it to be the Self. The Sukshma Sharira enlivens the human body and the mind, takes it to be the Self. Do plants have a Sukshma Sharira? Yes. What we know, plants don't have a mind and therefore don't take themselves to be a separate conscious being. Right? And the same with small children. Before they have an ahankara, they don't take themselves to be separate beings. Well, that the all living beings have a sukshma sharira. We can say that. Have a subtle body. If they're living, they've been born. But the upadi, like a plant upadi, has because of the physical upadi there, it has, the sukshma sharira has a limited expression. So it's whatever type of mind would be there, it would be very limited. What the sensory capacity would be limited by the nature of the upadi. It's just like for a human being, your sukshma sharira is full blown, it's capable of whatever the upadi can do, you know. As long as the physical upadi is functioning, then the sukshma sharira can use it. Like say if you're, for whatever reason, one, your arm doesn't work, your leg doesn't work, it's damaged, you know. Then the sukshma sharira is there, but it can't operate the damaged leg. Or if the upadi you've taken has certain limitations to it, whatever the limitations are there in the physical form, then that sukshma sharira is there, but it's not able to utilize the damaged upadi. Like just if you lose your hearing or your sight or anything like that. You know, the sukshma sharira is fine, but the upadi is not, or is limited. And so now say that you look at, say, dogs or cats or trees or plants or any living being, they all have sukshma shariras, but the sukshma sharira can only express in the way that physical upadi allows it to express. And so that still has that life force, it has prana, which will express in the way of the physical upadi. It has sensory, it has all of the sense organs, but that only express in a particular way. Like we've proven that plants are very sensitive to their environment. You know, they can feel fear, they can experience fear, and they can also experience shanti. We've all, you know, especially if somebody, an angry person or a threatening person, comes near any one of them, they all feel fear. We've measured all of that, you know. And then there's been a lot of work with how plants also communicate with each other when through sending out scents. You know, when one of them is in danger, to warn the other trees that there's danger coming. And then the trees have different things they can secrete into their leaves and things like that that make the menace that's coming toward them not want to eat them. Because it's either bitter or it's poisonous or this or that. So there's all these different forms of communication going on, but they have a sukshma sharira that is utilizing the upadi in that particular way. And elephants, all of these, but they all have sukshma shariras. They've just taken a human body or a non-human body or a fish body or an insect body. You know, and the Sukshma Sharira utilizes that body and can express through it. And some of those bodies, and any of these, can be damaged or not damaged. They can be very exalted. You know, the Sukshma Sharira is really able to make use of the physical upadhi. So yes, plants have a sukshma sharira. I don't know to what degree or not plants take themselves to be a separate, unique conscious being. Because they seem to just, plants and animals to a degree, they have feelings, they have emotions, they respond. They have a certain level of intelligence also, different than ours. I think that we're getting away from this trying to say this intelligence is superior to this intelligence. I think that's kind of meaningless in a way. Because every living being has its own form of intelligence and its own form of communication. But animals and plants don't seem to have the same type of free will. So it seems that we do to get ourselves into so much trouble. They have much more part of nature in a way. It's not that they don't have consciousness, it's not that they don't have feelings. I mean, we all know animals and living beings have feelings, you know. But they seem to be governed in a much more instinctual way. They're following their instincts and not the self-reflection. They have self-reflection, you know, but they don't seem to be worried very much about it. They seem to just be living in the present, like Ishwara. Sometimes I think, you know, they are one with Ishwara. They don't have the type of differentiation that we have. It's kind of like the Adam and Eve story. And they ate the apple, you know, and then all of a sudden started seeing things from their own perspective, you know, and became different from everything else. Everything really screwed up badly for them. we're all trying to make our way back. Yeah. Anyway, okay. Let's stop. There's one more left. Which one is it? We'll do it next. It's all right, Taylor. Other than that, that's not a hard one. It's just misty. Huh? Everything okay?
Yes.
Yeah?
Okay. I think she wants to do a budget.
What? You want to do a budget?
No.
Do you want to?
Tomorrow.
All right. We also
have some wonderful vocals here.
Okay, let's do some bhajans tomorrow. I mean, we'll do this too. We'll do this for a half an hour, and then we'll do bhajans. That would be wonderful.
Yeah.
You
want
to do that? You can bring your instruments tomorrow. So. We'll do like 15 minutes of, 20 minutes of satsang, and then have some nice bhajans. That would be so nice. Om swasti prajabhyah paripalayantam nyayena margena mahimahishah go brahmanebhyah shubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini Desho yamsho bharahitaha brahmana santu nirbhayaha
Om Sarvesham Swastir Bhavatu, Sarvesham Shantir Bhavatu, Sarvesham Purnam Bhavatu, Sarvesham Mangalam Bhavatu, Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha, Sarve Santu Niramayaha, Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu, Ma Kashchit Dukha Bhavet, Asato Ma Sadgamaya, Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya, Mrityor Ma Amritam Gamaya, Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavashishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.